buck was still silver, and it was back when the country was strong. Back before Elvis, before the Vietnam War came along.
Should we just jump into it? How much time do you have, Phil?
It's pretty open. It's sort of depending, but I don't have anything like pressing after it. I just have to get to bed early. So
all right. So I was thinking we could do maybe 1 hour on each chap, but if you don't have that much time, maybe we can like skip the intro and then just do the, you know, the 10 main chapters.
Yeah,
I will say that starting tomorrow, I'm doing something called Working the Tides. We've reached the phase of production now where we have to work at low tide. So every day we're going to start at a different time. Tomorrow, as I understand it, we're starting at 4 a.m. So
fun.
Doesn't mean that I have to leave like super early, but it also means that I can't be recording super late because I have to get to bed at like early, very early.
All right, Sean, I want you to, now that you've read Hell World, I want you to compose, as you're working in the tides, a Phil Neal style analysis of the structure of wage labor and the tides and the moon and climate change.
I can do that. I found the invocation in the beginning of the mist, you know. Phil, you used this wonderful metaphor of the mist, and of course it's like the effluent, like the acrid scents and smells and poisons and toxicity in the air that covers the large swath of the eastern seaboard and the Carolinas with industrial pig production. I happen to be working at a place filled with its own mist, a place called the Gowanus Canal, which, Phil, you're from the West Coast, you may not know, is the most polluted waterway in the entire country, which is really impressive. So we ourselves are facing a mist. We ourselves are on a has whopper job, and I'm doing all that I can to try to stay healthy. Every time that water touches me, I wash it off. And when I don't wash it off by accident, I know pretty quickly because you get a really nasty rash just from the water. So good stuff. I found your invocation of the mist to be very relevant to my lifestyle.
Yep.
All right, well, that's a good intro to the tone I want to set for this episode, because this is our annual Halloween episode, and perfect timing. I got this book in, I think, August, and I just finished it yesterday. I found it to be a breezy 900 pages. You know, some have said it's too long, but, you know, it's honestly, though, I did really love reading this book, and it went much faster than I expected. I thought I'd never get through it. But, I'm in a Discord where people are reading it, and they're kind of racing each other to try to finish it. And it seems like only one person has so far. But what kind of feedback are you getting in terms of the length?
Let me say, I think, to my knowledge, in the same week, I was contacted by, so my friend Nick Chavez, who's been on the show before, he finished it. He was the first person I heard of who finished it. But the same week, this Turkish group who wants to translate parts of it and did an interview about it, they also finished it. So it's either these Turkish guys who finished it first or Nick Chavez who finished it first. Probably like a month ago or something.
All right, add me to the list. I finished it yesterday.
Okay.
Probably didn't read it quite as closely as Nick, but I did my best.
Don't add me to the list. I read parts of it, decent-sized chunks of it, but I would not say, considering I'm working 50, 60 hours a week these days, that I read the whole thing. I'd be lying to you all if I said that. But I did find it great. Like Andy said, breezy. This Phil Neal fella's got a real way with words, I tell you.
Well, what you can do is you can put it on some headphones and you can listen to it in a hazardous working environment while you're destroying your body with physical labor. And that's really how it's meant to be read as well. An experience. So
gotcha. Well, I got that covered, man. I guess I'll just have to either get the dulcet tones of you reading it when the audio book comes out. I don't know if historical materialism does audiobooks. If they do, that's cool. Or we can plug it into the cursed AI And I could have like a machine, maybe a machine doing your voice, reading your words as I'm like trying not to fall into the Gowanus Canal. That would be fitting.
Yeah. So we're talking about Hellworld. It's Phil Neal's most recent masterpiece. If you've read some of his work in Brooklyn Rail or, you know, the recent thing in Ill Will that hopefully we'll get some time to talk about. It's very along those lines, but it is, like I said, approximately 900 pages. And I really love the intro of the book because that, you know, you really explain in this kind of lengthy intro what you're trying to do and even give some tips on how to read it. And I like the tone of it's kind of challenging the reader. Like, not only is this going to be very long, not only do you expect not everyone to finish it, but you kind of imply that it's too scary to finish, which I won't say my opinion on that, but I'll leave that up to the reader. But yeah, since this is the Halloween episode, maybe we can start just by talking about the Katabasis structure, the Lovecraftian horror of it. Yeah, what drew you to that style of writing?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I came to it eventually when I started to try to write, I think, a somewhat simpler book. It was a little bit more focused, and I realized two things. The first thing I realized is that I sort of had to make it global in scope and sort of all-encompassing with all of these things that I had been kind of studying and doing field work on. And, you know, I realized very quickly that I wasn't going to write a book, you know, about this Chinese industrial case. I'm not going to write a book about, you know, premature deindustrialization in Eastern Africa. Like, this all had to be sort of part of the same story. So it had to be planetary in scope. And then at the same time, I started to realize that the only way you can really talk about capital at this scale, right? Capital as a real totality, the total social capital, but also like the logic of capital, as this kind of planetary, now geospheric system, is through tropes from, you know, the cosmic horror genre. So Lovecraft is the most familiar of those, but part of the literary practice that I did for writing the book, especially once I had decided on this format, was just doing kind of like a giant speed run of basically reading like cosmic horror and some like Southern Gothic and some other things that are kind of proximate. So I read like a bunch of like Thomas Ligotti. I read Algernon Blackwood, who in my opinion is more interesting than Lovecraft. And he writes the scariest stories about trees that you'll ever read. A bunch of stuff that I just kind of studied kind of meticulously. I was reading a lot of Harry Cruse as well. Southern Gothic, like writ lit guy. And I was studying these on the one hand for kind of literary reasons, studying like sentence structure. Like there's few authors who write a sentence quite as beautifully as someone like Harry Cruse. But then at the same time, you have that sort of neurosis sort of approach that like Ligotti and Lovecraft really bring to their prose. And so I'm sort of emulating a lot of that and figuring out, okay, yeah, this is sort of the tone that we really need to talk about this emergent force that has this alien character that then invades, like its logic invades back onto us, but it's also somewhat inscrutable. And it has this character of like, you don't quite even know if it's, you know, intelligent in the way that we would think of it as intelligent. It's complex and it's powerful, right? And it has some sort of base intelligence, but is that intelligence just, you know, this kind of endless undead hunger thing, or is it something just more inscrutable to us, right? So all of these kind of factors went into the decision to make this, you know, like very cosmic horror lens talking about capital. This also draws, I mean, this is also a very traditionalist choice, and we're talking about like orthodox Marxism, right? There's nothing more orthodox about Marxism than Gothic like metaphors and Gothic themes, Gothic literary themes, right? Because those are all throughout Capital. Like the most common like literary references are all, you know, these dark Gothic kind of themes.
Yeah, and I like that you're it's very invariant to Marx and also to Bordiga and Camus to some extent, although you've got your critiques. But it moves kind of like weaves from your personal experiences and observations, your analysis, these historical narratives of the places where you're writing, China, Thailand, Hong Kong, Tanzania, Sudan, among others. Often these chapters climax or are like framed by these really incredible chunks of prose. And the one that really struck with me was when you were talking, because it's Katabasis was like this, you know, going into the underworld structure, and you were talking about going into some underworld and seeing these, you know, surreal horror images, these spirits and ghosts, and Mark sitting like a Buddha at the center of the labyrinth. And it only a few pages later do you reveal that everything you wrote there is literal. It was your literal perspective of, what was it, the Shenzhen subway system?
This was, so if you go to Chinese cities, especially back in the like early 2010s, and especially in the West, this was in Shenzhen. And I went back in 2024 and I found the place I had been writing about, which was still technically there at the time. It had been kind of shrunken a bit, but it was still there. But if you go to a lot of Chinese, if you went to a lot of Chinese cities in like the 2010s, especially out West, there was this kind of phenomenon where there was just a lot of like tunnels. Like you would go, there would underpasses under major roads, but those underpasses would sort of branch out. And they would essentially get turned into these little commercial spaces that were semi-informal, semi-formal. Like they'd have some shops that were in like these little nooks, and then other people just selling stuff sort of on the floor. They still have these in a lot of cities, like in across Guizhou is like they have a ton of these little tunnels because it's very mountainous. So you'll still see these places, but they're a little bit now. A lot of the time, they're really integrated with the formal subway system. You'll be walking underground for miles and miles through subway tunnels at different levels, and there's all these little shops there, but it's a lot more like, feels a little bit more like an airport nowadays. Whereas back then it was all like this really weird kind of info. You'd wander the wrong way and then you'd be like, I don't know if I'm supposed to be here. Like this looks like a sewer tunnel. And you just sort of wander through this area, and everywhere you would go, people were like selling these little things, like just all various knickknacks. Now in Shenzhen, the interesting thing is you can always find these strange, because it's the capital of global electronics production, and so it would also have like these weird kind of wholesale aspects to a lot of these commercial spaces. So people will be kind of like wholesaling like little electronic parts or little things that they kind of fixed, a bunch of just your normal phone cable type things, fixing phone cables, fixing phones, selling all kinds of little knickknacks as well, a bunch of little like accessories that you clip onto things. It's just all this kind of random stuff, but this sort of becomes this metaphor that I use to invert some of the structure that you see in Capital, right, where we're told, Capital like the book, where we're told, that production is like the hidden abode, and it's sort of portrayed as beneath society and churning there like an engine in the distance. And in this case, it's sort of interesting because in a way, the factories are all like above, if you're in Shenzhen, like the subway system, right? The factories are like above you. And then you're down in these spaces with all these shops and people kind of doing, all the logistical and commercial business is all kind of in the guts of the city and in these places. If you go higher up, you find the nice stuff, but this is like the kind of everyday sort of commerce. And it's where you can buy just, random weird little t-shirts and, street food and all kinds of stuff. So it's sort of this metaphor for these larger concepts I develop in the book about how we sort of understand what's gone on with mechanization, the role of kind of labor in the absence of mass industrial employment, et cetera, et cetera.
And, it's interesting.
Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, it's interesting when you bring up tunnels and you write about tunnels and how it's, these are sort of, in China, as part of a larger process of development, stop-start development. And you said that there's like this commercial infrastructure aspect to it. You take the United States, and over the last 5 years or so, there's been an incredible paranoia that's risen up around this idea of tunnels. Not one that China seems to have, or maybe it does, I don't know. But you're familiar with like the great pedo moral panic that we had recently. There was this, I saw a lot of this rhetoric of people trying to find the tunnels, you know, that people are trafficked in, that children are trafficked in, going into the desert and trying to dig up areas where they think the tunnels might exist, isolating various different old tunnels in urban spaces, unused tunnels in Manhattan or in Washington, D.C., that supposedly like the cabal of children traffickers are using, you know, these tunnels to move their wares around. And it just strikes me the way in which in the feverish mind of like 21st century America, a tunnel is not, you know, a place of commerce. It's not development waiting to happen. It's not even changing. It's like this evil substrate that exists underground, and it like reflects some pedophilic vampiric elite cabal that exists under the surface of everyday life and controls everything. I mean, that's what I think of as an American when I think of tunnels. I think of the deep paranoia. I don't know if that's a contrast that's relevant. What do you think?
Well, I live in Nashville now, and so we have the big controversy now over this next, Elon Musk tunnel deal, which has just been forced through. Basically, it's this very strange thing because Nashville is also the state capital. And so it's, you know, the location of the Republican state government, but it's also just a normal city. So it's obviously kind of like a liberal local municipal administration. But then they're always battling kind of over who has control of what. And obviously all the state level people are, you know, in the pockets of all the wealthy elite, very clearly at this kind of higher level. And they do all these business deals. They're opening a new evil Oracle campus on the east side of the river here. And then this tunnel thing where people have been kind of pushing for all the ways to like fix the roads and, you know, do all this kind of infrastructural stuff for years and years. And everything was going like agonizingly slow, and the roads are kind of like the worst. They're some of the worst that I've seen in terms of freeway design. But then also at the same time, like just in the past, less than a year, they basically signed the deal and started digging for this tunnel. It's just going to be like a Tesla only tunnel, just like in Las Vegas, right? Just this very Gilded Age style project. And it's sort of like it didn't go through any reviews. They just like the state government just forced it all through immediately. And then everyone else, you know, if you open like a news story about it, all the comments are just like, give us like a fucking train, like just like give us anything else to just get to, like he goes to the airports downtown, like just give us any kind of transit, you know. But it's, I think this is also kind of the other emanation of what you were just saying, right? It's like the tunnels are kind of like these dark spaces, but they're also these symbols of like these massive types of corruption and collusion, right? Where they're just seen as like not this kind of vast spaces of kind of thriving commerce and development, but like these huge, weird, corrupt, kind of shitty sinks for someone's kind of backroom business deal money, right? Because these tunnels also suck. Like those, I don't know if you guys have seen the videos of like the Tesla tunnel in Vegas. It's like
a bullshit
tunnel.
It's such a
worst tunnel I've seen.
Worst tunnel. The Chinese would never. You know, we have our own tunnel issue here in New York. Andy, you're familiar with the Gateway Tunnel project that's going on?
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about the Kabod Tunnel in Crown Heights.
I thought about it, but I didn't bring it up, but you did. Of course, there. I don't know, Phil, if you saw, like, it broke the internet like 6 months ago when it turns out that under like a, was it a Chabad house or was it a synagogue?
It was the main Chabad synagogue. Like the capital of the Chabad movement.
There was tunnels that like the Jungermen like were making for God knows what reasons, but it like broke the internet because all the anti-Semites came out and were like, see, I told you there's Jews in the tunnel, and then they're doing pedo stuff or whatever. But what I was referring to, Andy, was not in your febrile imagination, you know, like the Jew tunnels or whatever it is that you automatically jump to.
You were talking about a Goy tunnel.
I'm talking about a Goyish tunnel, okay? About as Goy as it gets. It's called the Gateway Tunnel, and it's basically the addition for the Hudson Tubes, which got flooded out by Sandy. It's going to increase capacity at Penn Station. Something, it's a project that's been needed for 20 or 30 years or so. Anyways, Donald Trump just took away $16 billion from the project. So, like, Elon Musk gets, I guess, fast track approval in Nashville and Las Vegas to do his like bullshit Tesla tunnels. But the various different political back and forth of this huge infrastructure project, which is going to move millions of people every week, keeps getting jammed up over and over again by state and national politics. And as of right now, that $16 billion just completely doesn't exist. And Lord knows it's going to get even worse once Trump declares war on the city when Mamdani becomes mayor. But anyways, tunnels. New York has its own tunnels, political tunnels.
Yeah, let me try to tunnel out of this diversion a little bit.
Yes, please.
Because, you know, you're bringing up the government shutdown right now, Trump doing increasingly warlike maneuvers on the U.S. public. And just this sense of, like, we're fucked. That seems to be, you know, intentionally signaled from the government right now on a number of levels. And even in New York, where, you know, a lot of people my age are very excited about Zohran, like, hanging over the whole thing is just, like, Trump is going to, you know, go to war with us now for even hoping that this Bill de Blasio-style social Democrat can give us a few little marginal wins, you know, and make our lives a little bit more affordable. And this is something that kind of, you know, that's the sort of mist running through Hell World, I think, is this this sense of doom, this sense of crisis. And then, you know, this is sort of jumping to the conclusion, actually, this idea that we're witnessing, you know, something like a breakdown, the poly crisis and this sort of thing. And combined with that are these intentional efforts, you talk about Gaza specifically as part of this, to make us not only feel like, okay, well, this system is collapsing, but also we should not have any hope about it. Because the way the system is going to deal with this collapse is just increasing levels of murderous cruelty. So yeah, maybe you can talk a little bit about that motif in the book, or if you want, you can try to summarize critique of the poly crisis and or your perspective on breakdown.
Yeah, so a lot of that comes through in the final chapter, which talks about Gaza, talks about the revolution and civil war in Sudan. And it also sort of sums up a lot of these other kind of debates about crisis, stagnation, development, et cetera, dealt with throughout the book. But one of the things that the book does kind of throughout, really before addressing that, before addressing kind of all the themes of kind of catastrophe in this large scale, is it also looks very specifically at these cycles of development, individual crises, such as the crisis in 2008, but it also has a bunch of examples from like the Asian financial crisis, the Japanese real estate collapse, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that it really stresses is that each time there's these individual crisis moments that are sort of epitomized by these economic crises, but they have all these kind of political dimensions. They can spill over into these revolutionary moments. And then they could sort of reconfigure the field of power, basically. So one of the core points is also that they turn into these developmental bursts. So the whole first, you know, several chapters of the book talk about basically how the 2008 crisis sort of launched this particular developmental drive in China in this particular way through this massive build out of infrastructure. Later in chapter 8, the long one, chapter 8, which is this big history of development. It also talks about how crises have done this again and again and again, how you see these crises, they reconfigure kind of the upper echelons of corporate power. They make these kind of big moves. Also, they stimulate these big moves toward like the redevelopment of physical infrastructure, of the infrastructure of capital. That also restructures then global trade like 20, 30 years down the line. So every time individual crises happen, they also shuffle kind of the, they shuffle the power structure, and then they stimulate new drives of development that are simultaneously these drives of demolition. But they're, you know, one of the things that I really try to get through in some of those early chapters is that it's not like this whole image of China being just overdeveloped and full of ghost cities and all this stuff is going to get used. Like there's a very good argument for overcapacity in certain sectors, for overconstruction of like railways, et cetera, but like this is actual development. Like these are actual buildings. These are actual freeways that are being used. These are actual high-speed rails that function, right? And this is very different from what a lot of Americans kind of feel, right? Like we've gone through an entire generation without seeing anything that really looks like development, so much so that now there's this whole, folk politics that basically equates development as such with socialism, that if it's development, it's socialist inherently, right? Because it's been so long since we've actually seen ourselves firsthand in our lives, the developmental force of capital. But capital has always been a developmental force. And that's what that long chapter is about. It's capital as a developmental force that moves through this kind of sequence of development and demolition. And that even in periods of kind of long stagnation, it has this, you know, capacity to kind of restructure the world. So when it comes to crisis, catastrophe, et cetera, one of the key things that happens in like the crisis in 2008, for example, is this, you know, it instigates this particular developmental boom in China in this particular way. But then at the same time, it also really reshuffles the upper echelons of corporate power in the world and in the U.S. So a lot of companies that had been at the head of the top of the corporate ladder, right? They get deposed. So General Electric almost collapses. General Motors becomes a state-owned company for a while. All of this happens kind of all at once, right? And then, but what happens then is not that whatever Chinese or Japanese or European companies ascend to occupy those positions. That really doesn't happen. Instead, what happens is these other American companies go to the top of the Fortune 500, right? So that's when you have the ascent of the big tech, basically. Big tech plus these new kind of hedge fund, mutual fund type asset management, kind of new financial firms. And then JP Morgan becomes like the only bank in the world, basically, at this kind of very high level. So it reorganizes power like that. And so one thing is that in the U.S., I think that people in some senses are too comfortable in their pessimism. But we have to remember that like the US has supposedly been on the brink of collapse since like the 1970s, right? It just happens again and again. People say, oh yeah, everything's collapsing. Can't you see it? And if you were to look actually at the stuff going on in the 1970s, I would say it's still worse, right? It's still clearer signs of like an imminent collapse than what we have today. Like the social enemy, the, you know, people bombing Wall Street, all kinds of crazy shit is going on then. But it doesn't collapse, right? It doesn't collapse. Japan doesn't become the hegemonic power that, as is predicted, you know, none of that stuff happens. The U.S. reconfigures, it reascends, it reestablishes its power. So one of the things is there are these long run trends in hegemony and the way that global power works within capital, within the imperialist structure of the global economy. But at the same time, there's like this massive kind of inertia as well. And there's this reinvention of corporate power at the top. So in one sense, a lot of the stuff that's happening is much more mundane if you just trace, you know, trace it as like a process of like corporate ascension within the military industrial part of the economy, which didn't get shaken up as much in 2008, but now after 2020 has started to weaken a lot. So now Boeing can get deposed by SpaceX, right? And now a bunch like Lockheed Martin and stuff, they have to deal with these other new military industrial tech firms that are gonna be the new competitors. So in one sense, we also have to understand these kind of crises things as specifically not, you know, this catastrophic collapse. And this is the point that I make at the end of the book, is very much offering a theory of crisis that is basically a counter to a theory of collapse or catastrophe, right? But that also accounts for the fact that, you know, capital is always going to be reproducing and actively producing these crises as its form of development.
And so getting sort of your conclusions from that, you're wary of the sort of mechanistic optimism that breakdown just produces revolution or something like that. You try to keep it subjective, but there is this optimistic sort of reading of it that's like, well, with every breakdown, there's this higher probability that these revolutionary subjectivities come into play. And I think you said something like the revolution in Sudan was the highest form of that we've seen. Can you go into what exactly happened there and why you were interested in that specifically?
So, yeah, there's a couple different strands there. The first thing is, I basically argue that there is no tendency toward collapse, basically. There is no tendency towards collapse. There's no extrinsic thing that's going to limit capital such that it will inherently collapse. There's ways that you can imagine that it could get out of these extrinsic limits. There is also no intrinsic collapse tendency, and it's certainly not revolutionary when it happens. That those are all kind of balance of subjective forces kind of questions, the political shape that it takes in the midst of it. But but there are these secular trends that I kind of identify that are somewhat cyclical, but there's a couple long-term trends that are very easy to kind of see, and that they set a certain stage for what has to happen for development, like new developmental bursts or for, new productivity waves to kind of pass through the economy. And then there's also these kind of just long-term, socio-technical trends that you see. And so one of the things that you really see is, obviously, you see a tendential increase in mechanization and automation. You also see then, as a share of the population, the people directly employed in production does shrink over time. Right, so that's a key thing. That also means that more of the people who are employed are going to be working in services, in reproductive sectors, and reproductive understood very broadly here, reproductive in the sense of like doing day-to-day reproductive work, but also in the sense of like most like government employment, right, is also reproductive, social reproduction, right, in the social reproduction kind of business. So we see, so this also leads to the second tendential trend that we see is a larger and larger share of basically revenue and expenditure, and also kind of employment in its certain sense. It's harder to measure in that way, but being tied to the state, right? Tied to like government support in some fashion. And this is one of those things where I think a lot of people point at China and they're like, oh yeah, it's a state capitalist model. But one of the key things that I argue in the book is actually that if you look at all the data, is China is way behind countries like the US when it comes to like the share of total expenditure or revenue that goes to the state. And that's even higher in the US if you include all these kind of weird public-private things, as well, or state subsidized industries or industries that wouldn't really exist without certain regulatory structures like so much of the US like healthcare and insurance kind of infrastructure, right? These are like kind of welfare employment, but with American characteristics. And then also actually a lot of construction basically functions like this as well, where there's a lot of this kind of dependence on this weird kind of state financial asset bubble thing that has a lot of shady stuff going on, like these tunnels that we're talking about. So really what we're looking at is these kind of long-term trends that do set up some conditions over time that I argue that basically it makes crises kind of more common, more difficult. If there is like a really foundational collapse, it would be enormous at this point. It makes it very difficult to do the things that you need to really recover from crises, which are usually war and the actual destruction of life and fixed capital. And then it also makes it much more devastating when those things start to happen again. But in addition to that, you have a lot of infrastructure to prevent the crisis from breaking out in the first place. So you have all this macroeconomic management mechanisms. But, and this is like a classic argument from Brenner, when you do that, but by preventing the crisis from really taking its full shape and issuing bankruptcies across the economy, you're also propping up all these kind of inefficient firms, and you're getting this kind of long run stagnation, et cetera, et cetera. So to get to the second kind of part is like, what is this example from Sudan, and what does that really matter here? So on the one side, it kind of offers a symbol, just like some of these other very grim kind of symbols like Gaza, and we can pick any number of like the wars that I list at the beginning of that chapter. it offers a symbol of like war as an increasing war and kind of militia management of supply chains as an increasingly kind of common and kind of salient feature of just production itself, right? And I talk about how this isn't someplace it's just like abandoned by global capital. It's a huge source of gold. It's the biggest gold rush in the world across the Sahel there. And in Sudan is a big part of it. And there's these massive kind of gold mines, and it's integrated with like refugee population goes and works at a gold mine as they're kind of leaving. And the gold mines also pull in these people, refugees from all over the continent and all over the region. And it's like very kind of modern. They're importing machinery and equipment from China. And then there's the gold is getting smuggled out to the UAE, where then it's being used to kind of bankroll these massive financial projects and investment things that they're doing in the Gulf states, that the Gulf states are also doing all over the world. And so it's very thoroughly integrated within global supply chains, within global financial markets. And so on the other side, I'm also kind of arguing that Sudan is an interesting example because it's an example where you really see, you know, the employment structure is what you kind of see throughout that region, but also increasingly throughout the world as a whole. And I talk about, you know, several times in different respects in different places in the book, which is this, you know, massive amount of the population just kind of exists in this sort of informal economy, in this service economy, doing stuff that they may not even be being paid a formal wage for. Sometimes it's almost kind of barely work. It's like also sort of household duties, but some of it is monetized. And all of these sort of activities actually become somewhat important in the revolutionary period because they form the basis of the formation of these resistance committees, basically at these neighborhood levels. So like these neighborhood revolutionary organs that form, and a very important part of them is they form in part through the participation of all these people who are involved in this informal kind of service economy throughout, you know, rural and urban areas. There's like agricultural kind of context to it. There are plenty of examples that are kind of like higher end services, the professional association, which also had a bunch of people who had formerly been in or were still in the Sudanese Communist Party. There's a bunch of overlap there. So like teachers, nurses, doctors, et cetera, et cetera. They were a huge force in organizing kind of early protests and whatnot. I mean, there's tons of detail to how this thing actually happened. But the interesting thing about the Sudanese case is that it's not like if you look at like Myanmar right now in the civil war, right? They seem to be very effective at using this kind of very traditional, you know, what are basically called like ethnic armed organizations in the area. It's kind of very traditional, like national liberation, peasant army style of combat, right? And they're pretty proficient at it, and they seem to be doing fairly well at it, right? And then if you look at like the Kurdish example, kind of a similar thing, but it has this revolutionary aspect, but it's kind of coming from the outside. And a lot of the organs, the revolutionary organs are sort of like, they're trying to get them started, but they didn't organically arise in that location. Right. So there's sort of this weird back and forth. If you read a lot of the documentation about it, like there's always a struggle over actually getting people to adopt them and actually getting the communes to function, the co-ops to start. But Sudan is one of the few cases where you really see these organic, you know, council-like structures arise at the neighborhood level. They play an important role in the revolution. If they have a failure, right, it's not really on that end. It's more on the fact that they weren't ready to do the thing that they're actually good at in, like, the Myanmar case, which is, like, defending yourself against military assault, right? And so that creates the political situation where your only choice is like this, the lesser of two evils, national army against the rapid support forces, right? But it's really an interesting case where you see these revolutionary organs forming somewhat organically in, like out of what, you know, theoretically at this high level of abstraction is just this sort of like informal economy, surplus population kind of forms a circulation.
I'm taking it all in, and I wish I had read the Sudanese part. This sounds fascinating. You know, Sudan is only ever really brought up anymore, it seems like, in the news or in public discourse when somebody's trying to get your attention away from other genocides, other massacres happening a little bit to the north and east of there. So the Sudanese example that you're mentioning is really fascinating to me.
It's at the end. It's also the part of the book for anybody listening. It's also one where I really wish it's the one part where I really wish I had a lot more time to get into the details and to circulate the draft around. And one thing I'd really appreciate is if, anybody who is really even more familiar has personal experience in the Sudanese kind of sequence, reads it and thinks like, oh yeah, that point is bullshit. You know, like write a review, write a critique of it, elaborate the critique. Because I think it is something that people really need to be discussing a lot more and debating a lot more, right? It just, whether or not the exact positions I'm taking are, there's a bunch of details that have shifted now, obviously, in the intervening time, but it's just something that needs to be talked about more and examined more and learned from a lot more, I think.
Yeah, especially in the context of these similar uprisings that we've seen in the last few months that people are kind of calling Gen Z uprisings. And I think in some cases that's, you know, Nepal, that it does seem to be very young, Madagascar as well. But obviously these are massive uprisings. It's not just kids watching anime who start these things, you know? Mm-hmm. But the way you describe Sudan at points sounds very similar to these sort of spontaneous movements that we could sort of theorize some communist elements to it, or some communist methods or visions or trajectories. But there is also a sense of sort of nihilism and hopelessness that overhangs all of it.
Well, one of the big things that I think, so I talk a lot about this kind of sense of nihilism. I do it in the Hong Kong example in particular, where it's a lot more kind of grim, not just because it gets crushed, but also because of like, who is really the driving force of the protests at a certain point with the localists, with these far right. Many of them are like, you know, essentially kind of libertarian fascists. many of them really love the U.S. and they're going to meeting, these conservative politicians. And this is during Trump's first, administration initially.
They love
so
Pepe.
It's kind of this.
Pepe was a huge, Pepe was like their one piece.
Yeah, I remember being in Hong Kong and just seeing these Pepes all over the sidewalks, just everywhere. And it was very fascinating.
crazy.
But also I was in Hong Kong and, in 2024, and it was just like, that's all. It's crazy also how much that was just stripped off the city. Like, it was everywhere. And I'm like, I'm just like, literally, how did you get the graffiti out of some of these places? Because it was everywhere.
Chinese efficiency.
But there's this grim nihilistic kind of aspect to it. I dig into that more in that sort of chapter. But one of the key things I think that distinguishes Sudan, even from these other kind of youthful revolts. Now, the youthful revolts they're always messy. They're easy to romanticize. A lot of them, I don't really know exactly what's going on because I don't know the political situation of Madagascar that well. In Nepal, I sort of do. And then you also get the fact that, like, as soon as something happens, if there's some sort of geopolitical thing, right, whoever is the nearest enemy gets involved as well. So like you had all this right wing kind of Hindutva like associated money flowing into the protests at a certain point through certain organizations, right? But it's also fairly clear that there's this big organic kind of base to the protests initially. But the key thing I think that's very different about Sudan and that people often don't realize is that it's also, yeah, it's a lot of youth who get involved in it, but it has, just due to some of the unique kind of factors of the location, it has this lineage that's kind of within living memory. There was these earlier sequence of protests in the early 2010s and in like 2013 that were really where these resistance committee structures were first launched. And so they're not invented in the late 2010s. They are kind of resurrected, revived, repurposed, and then spread in new ways and reinvented. And then they also have, like I said, like the Sudanese Professional Association is what gets mentioned, but there's a bunch of like old leftists from like the Sudanese communist movement, the Sudanese socialist movement, and stuff, who all got involved in those sort of organizations over time. And so there's these elements of kind of institutional memory that other places, were broken more thoroughly or haven't been redeveloped. But it's also a really great example, I think, of how even when you're defeated in the past, right, it can kind of spawn and spread these kind of new living examples. Like another example from Sudan, it's very interesting. It's very tragic, right? That the revolution gets crushed. It devolves into kind of this civil war in this particular fashion. But at the same time, you know, looking at political events in the immediate years after that, you would see all these Sudanese activists, like kind of involved, who have been fled and had to flee, right? Who are now involved in these other political circles, right? In Nairobi, in Toronto, in just all over the world, right? You see people kind of popping up. It's very similar to, you know, after 1848 in Europe, and especially in Germany, then you have all these people who flee, and then you have people like Marx and Engels hanging out in London, right? So you kind of have this phenomenon of that actually seeds some of this intelligence even wider. So I think people get really take this kind of grim view when these things get crushed, but it is very much this, you know, image of like the police stomping on a fire and the sparks and the embers are going to fly off somewhere else and ignite some other things because they're stomping on it.
Someone call that permanent revolution.
Your focus on capital, the logic of capital, the social logic of capital as a planetary phenomenon, as maybe in our lifetimes, I wouldn't say it's completed its global reach, but certainly gotten close to it. You're right from the outset, you say that you want to look at political economy, you want to understand industry, you want to understand supply chains, not from a national political economy, but internationally. And now I see you're doing the same thing with social movements that are arising now. So we're living through, I think, right now, a very nationalist moment, right? Even the much of the left in the Anglophone world is now obsessed with geopolitics, obsessed with multipolarity, obsessed with, you know, what might be the beginning of World War III, we don't know, which is the Russia-Ukraine war. But your book, I think, rightfully takes a different tact, a different turn. Talk about a little bit about the choices, that choice that you made, and why it's important right now to refocus ourselves and our attention.
Yeah, so this is... Again, this is something where I would just say it's very like orthodox Marxist position, not just the idea of being internationalist, but the idea of starting from this view of the total social capital, right? If you read Capital, you know, Marx, it seems like he's talking about like a single company, but what he's really talking about is basically take this single company and sort of treat it as the entire capital, right? We could talk about capital as such, sort of through discussion of like this single commodity, this single company, right? And he's abstracting away a lot of these other things. Paul Maddock has a great book about this, Theory as Critique, where he talks about how he does these, he structures these sort of models. So one of the key things, and I think that this is, so the other thing that the book does, right, which is also very orthodox, is this idea of learning to see sort of through these alienated appearances of capital, but also understanding that they're like real, right? They're these kind of abstractions that have a real force in the world. So what that means in this case is basically saying, okay, look, this geopolitical appearance of the world, right? This sort of colloquial image that like we live right in America and our society is different than Chinese society, right? Just taking a step back and saying, no, if we trace like things like material flows, like what in like archaeology would call the material culture of a civilization, right? You very clearly see this kind of link. And if you treat any of these commodities around us, right, as social relations, right, as these social relationships to the people who produce them, then it's actually very obvious that almost anybody listening here probably has more social relation, more social interaction with people in Chinese factories than they do with other Americans, right? Because you interact so regularly with goods, with material things, right, that have passed through these hands, right, that if you want to think of it as like, you know, back in the old days, you lived in a village and you have the, you know, the butcher and the blacksmith and stuff. And, you know, those are your social relations, and they're your social relations, not because you live next to them, but also because like you do stuff for each other. They produce, you know, you give the guy a pig, he cuts it up, he keeps some of the meat, he gives you the rest of the meat, the blacksmith, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So those sort of social relationships now exist at this planetary scale. And we don't, in capital, in the logic of liberalism, we treat them as like, you know, ethically settled through the wage, through the flow of payments. And the communist point is just, you know, these have to be become basically the self-reflexive focus of kind of rational management of these planetary kind of social relationships that were already enmeshed within. And so there's this false appearance, right, that we live, it's not a false appearance, it's an alienated appearance, which means that it has a real effect, right? So we can say, yeah, we live in America, right? And it's an alienated appearance. Really, we're part of the same planetary society called capitalism, right? That has the same basic social structures, the same atomic social structure everywhere, the same property system everywhere, right? The same system of contract, the same dependence on money for survival, et cetera, everywhere, or basically everywhere. There's a few pockets where you could say it's not the case, but, and also you're breathing literally the air that is produced by, you know, these factories, that this particular mix of chemicals, right, is generated by the force of accumulation, quite literally. So in all of those senses, right, you're really kind of exist within this kind of larger society, but at the same time, those national divides and those geopolitical things are also real, right? If I try to cross the border back into the U.S. without my U.S. passport, it's going to be difficult. It's a real thing. I also would have access to the sort of things that exist within these national markets, which do exist, right? Like there's a bunch of things for which the market is very local or national or whatever. So there are these, you know, subsets of locality, of nationality. These geopolitical conflicts are very real. In fact, they're more real now than they have been recently. They're much more salient. Crises immediately take on a geopolitical aspect now, when before that maybe didn't even happen, or it you know, kind of happened later, or the consequences become clear later. But now it's like any economic crisis, almost immediately a geopolitical crisis. This is the whole thing that the liberals really like with polycrisis, treating them all as kind of different, but they're actually very clearly part of this same dynamic, right? They're so clearly connected now, whereas before they were maybe arguably a lot more disarticulated or whatever.
Yeah, so maybe jumping back to the subjective realm, or like in spooky terms, jumping back to the specter of proletarian revolt, there's a chunk, I think it's at the end of chapter 4, where you start talking about the concept of the party, the historical party. And you talk about the concept of an anti, like A-N-T-E political versus pre-political, and talking about the 2010s revolts as sort of anti-political in that sense, getting into the memes as sigils stuff, and building this concept of your own sort of proposal for a concept of the party that you elaborate on in this recent Ill Will piece that we'll link in the show notes. Do you want to try to get into that theory a bit, or describe your concept of the party that you're working at here?
Yeah, I could try to do it kind of briefly. The Ill Will piece really gets into it much more directly than Hell World does. Hell World gives us a lot of like illustrations of what I'm talking about, but it doesn't necessarily step back and give you like the theory of it really laid out super clearly. The Ill Will piece does a lot more of that.
I'm glad you did that, by the way, because I was like just trying to describe that to somebody. I'm like reading Hell World, it's right in the middle of it. And then you put out the Ill Will piece. I'm like, okay, now I can just link that instead.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it also is something where that Ill Will piece was initially, I was thinking of actually tacking on like this appendix at the end that was basically that piece. And then I was like, no, it's too fucking long already. I'm not going to do that. but yeah, I can kind of summarize it very quickly. The basic idea is just that. So when we talk about the party, what we're really talking about are kind of like these multiple things. One of those things is this larger kind of category that I call the historical party, which is basically just this idea that there's the internal contradictions of capital will always produce these individual forms of kind of class conflict, which will get particular like incendiary at particular moments for particular reasons, but they're always there and they're kind of simmering and they go through these kind of ebbs, these kind of highs and lows of how active it is at any time. That's traditionally kind of theorized as this idea that you go through like these cycles of struggle and they're sort of packeted together, right? So there's kind of this ebb and flow and they don't all, like there's these long kind of dry periods where it doesn't seem like a lot's happening and there's these brief periods where it's kind of popping off everywhere, right? But there's also this idea that every time that these are happening, there's these kind of low-level day-to-day struggles, which I call like subsistence struggles because they're over basically the terms of subsistence or how those terms are imposed on the population. But then there's also these moments, which drawing from Badiou, I call political events, but we could just think of as these larger scale rebellions, right? Or insurrections or whatever. There are these moments where so much happens, like the conflict gets so large so fast that it becomes this kind of generalized rebellion against kind of everything. It often has a sort of loose focus on the government sometimes, but usually that's also linked to some sort of, you know, industrial side as well. And the important point about those is that they also have this self-reflexive character where a lot of people who participate in them kind of have this fidelity to this general opposition to the world, right? As it is, and they think they're kind of changing it or, you know, instigating some sort of change by toppling the government or something, however they personally think about it. But what they also become very focused on is how can they continue the rebellion itself? How can they spread this thing that's happening to more people? How can they intensify it? How can they really make it threaten those in power? Those sort of questions, right? And through that self-reflexivity, they start to kind of form this partisan subject at this this very kind of subconscious level at that point. This historical party kind of forms through that. And it has this invariant aspect where it kind of projects this image of communism sort of in the negative because people are like listing out all the things they hate about how the world works now, right? It sort of has all these implied elements of how it could work better, right? And then people, one of the key kind of individual knowledge level things is people actually start to discuss what they mean, right? So they discuss how do they think that the world is bad and who is responsible, who should be deposed, and how does power work? How do we oppose that? And then what sort of things would rectify that, right? And that's usually the moment also where these things collapse because people can't agree on that stuff. It's very pre-subjective. It's anti-political, anti-E in this kind of sense where it's not quite at the level of like a political program. People don't really have an articulated politics. A lot of people just have this kind of maybe nihilistic sort of rejection or these things, but these things start to begin to be kind of articulated. From that, you get a lot of these functional groups that sort of form to extend, push forward, intensify this political event, this rebellion that's happening. Also, they try to articulate that political vision that they have, how things could be better. And these, whether they understand themselves to be, organized groups or not, they are organized, they are formalized because they are self-reflexive, they're conscious of what they're trying to do. And so in that sense, they have this formal aspect, even if they think of themselves as informal affinity groups, right? They sort of have these customary forms, in that case, like these customs through which they're doing formal organizing, right? And so you have these things that actually do emerge from these sort of cycles, these kind of forms of institutional knowledge, these practical forms of experience of like how to do some of these things. The resistance committees are a great example in Sudan where you had this sort of knowledge of these things that gestated in the early 2010s and that was maybe transmitted from older revolutionary organizing. And then it gets picked up again at the late 2010s. So that allows for the proliferation of these things that I call formal parties, which are these kind of, like I said, these little makeshift kind of functional groupings. They're always a little bit ephemeral, but they can often also get quite big, right? They try to, after the rebellion, like the ones that survive through the rebellion, they try to basically prepare the stage, prepare themselves and prepare the stage for the next rebellion and think about what they should do when it happens, right? How should they they usually think like, how should we intervene or what can we do to make things that sort of thing more likely, more people agree that the system has to be changed, right? And in that process, many of them degenerate and they go through this ossification. What I talk about is an ossification. They kind of harden up. And when the next rebellion happens, it turns out that they aren't partisan organizations at all. They've become just, you know, civil society organizations, institutions, and they actually take a conservative stance toward the rebellion, right? So they suddenly are in this suppressive role now, even though they think they're supporting it, they're really saying, well, no, we want to, you know, take the march to City Hall, like that sort of thing. So these former parties often kind of decay. And what verifies whether an organization remains partisan or not, or whether it's retained fidelity to that partisan undercurrent in history, is when the next rebellion happens. What does it do? What function does it serve? Is it able to engage with it? Does it have things to give to that rebellion? Has it helped make that rebellion happen, enabled it in the first place, right? And so one... So that can happen over time. And we have examples from history, from revolutionary history, where we see this circuit being formed. These rebellions happen. They form all these little formal apparatuses that come out of them, people who are like partisans in their kind of mind and spirit, and they try to organize. They try to intervene back into conditions after the rebellion has ended to make more rebellions possible, to make them able to turn into revolutions, right? They have another rebellion. They prove that they are able to engage in it. They get maybe bigger or stronger or maybe not, but that rebellion creates more partisans, right? Those people do the same thing. And you get this circuit that forms. And once you have that circuit between the formal and the historical party, between this kind of pre-subjective and very loosely or primitively subjective form of partisanship that you see in these little formal parties, then you have the emergence of this higher order revolutionary subjectivity, this higher order partisan subjectivity, which is what the Communist Party is and has usually been described, historically as, you know, federations of communist parties in an international or as just the international communist movement or something like that. But it's a little bit more organized than that because it does have these kind of organizational structures in, for the example of like these very specific large formal parties that are playing this special role and confederating and, you know, integrating all this activity. So that kind of higher order emergent form of subjectivity is really what we're talking about when we talk about the Communist Party. So it's like not the idea that there's a single formal party, right, that calls itself the Communist Party that everyone joins and it becomes the revolutionary force. It's that people are going to talk about it in different ways, in different places, but there's this kind of invariant communist content that they have to retain this fidelity to. It expresses itself in these kind of these ruptures with the status quo, these big rebellions, that then create kind of these openings to create more partisans and also to launch these kind of insurrectionary moments that can turn, you know, in the classical terms, turn the class war kind of into this like revolutionary civil war, right?
Yeah, so a lot of when you're going through this throughout the book and looking at different uprisings in the different places you're talking about, you're sort of weighing the 2010s communizer thesis against orthodoxy that you express at certain points of the book, where you do say that you do talk about Bordiga and Lenin as like very advanced thinkers on these subjects. So just to like kind of drive it home, like at what point, for example, in the George Floyd uprising or in Hong Kong or Sudan, who's the historical party in that moment? And then are other elements of the uprising, even though they're partisans fighting together, the forces of order, you know, or is everything just sort of forming in this direction and we haven't quite seen it yet?
Well, so the book contains a lot of examples. Like when you get down to these more granular scales of like an individual rebellion, you can kind of pluck out these kind of currents. So in the case of Thailand, I sort of talk about this, where we're basically looking at, you know, who's serving as kind of this party of order versus this kind of party of anarchy, right? And who's serving this weird kind of far right role where they are basically this anti-party. They have this kind of particularly reactionary view, which is usually kind of expressed in like this fascistic politics.
So now you're saying anti with an I? Now it's an anti?
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
Anti-party. Okay.
Anti-party, yeah.
Makes it hard to talk about out loud.
I know. But they, so basically there's, you can break this kind of down somewhat, but the thing with the historical party in particular is that it's not individual groups of people. It's the class in motion, basically, in a particular type of motion where you see it manifest as this emergent effect, right? Just in the same way that you would see a wave form on the ocean, right? We could talk about the wave itself, right, as this force, right? And so that's what we're talking about when we talk about the historical party, is like when the class gains this force and exerts a sort of assault onto some sort of structure of power at this mass scale. So it's not an individual movement, right? It's not like a little demonstration where people go and are advocating for their interests. It's something bigger than that. It's very hard to measure exactly when that happens, but it's also extremely clear when that happens. Like when you're embedded in it, you feel the difference between a regular protest and something like the George Floyd rebellion. It's very clear. The difference is very clear at this intuitive level, but it's also really, really hard to actually pin down and say when something hits that mark. But one clear necessity, right, is that it hits some sort of mass scale where it becomes extremely messy. So is one of the kind of key elements of it. But basically, everybody who's participating in it and pushing it forward is a part of that partisan force, essentially. Everybody, right? They have this kind of partisan aspect to what they are doing, whether or not they think of it or not. Like even if the right-wing conspiracy theory is true and the first window is broken by some outside agitator cop, right? Even if that is true, that person is serving as a part of the partisan force, right? Because they are in fact initiating a rebellion, whether or not they think that's, you know, just an excuse to crack down or whatever. Like it is a historically progressive act, regardless of how they think about it. So there's this idea of like, everyone is sort of caught up in it, right, at this certain point. And then once it happens, people take. So one of the other reasons that it's a partisan thing is that it draws a line. People have to take a side at that point. They kind of have to say, OK, I'm for this. I'm against this. Or I want to somehow try to distance myself from it. But that's just a different way, right, of being against it usually, but sometimes for it in this weird way. And then there's different levels of activity to that. So then there's people who actively mobilize against it. There's people who go and they say, no, these people are looting downtown. We're going to drive down there in our trucks and we're going to stop them, right? And then those people end up getting their asses kicked or something. Like, though, there's these sort of things, right? These vigilante actions, right? There's these people who are like, I'm going to shoot these people, right? And then they, like, that's the kind of forces of order. Part of this forces of order or these kind of reactionary forces take these sort of shapes. There's also these fascistic forces that are the anti-ANTI party, where they actually all want to use it for their own ends as well, but to foreclose this kind of partisan or communistic kind of vision that arises in it, but also they're using it for their own kind of purposes of power, which is part of what happened in Ukraine, right? Then in Euromaidan, it began, there was this rebellion, but it had this very strong right-wing current, and that right-wing current was able to use it to then instigate the total militarization of the state in the subsequent years against Russia with all these fascistic elements. So there's this idea that it kind of makes people take these kind of sides and make these kind of actions. And it's very hard to emulate the feeling of it. It's very hard to kind of emulate kind of that kind of feeling and how fast people individually are shifting, how fast they're kind of trying to learn these things, how fast they're shifting their own forms of political expression, and also how fast they can really just zigzag between basically like left and right positions in the midst of this sort of thing. The only depiction I've seen that actually gets that feeling somewhat correct is that movie Eddington.
I was hoping you were going to say that, because that's what I loved about it too. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the only thing I would say, like, it's the only movie I think I have seen that really feels like the early 2020s. Like, it just has that feeling. Like, that's how it felt. I'm going to show the film to like grandchildren and say, that's what it was really like, yep. Kids.
Yeah. You know, and I have my own theory that he was reading some Noel Ignatieff. because there's like that reference to race trees in there that, I mean, it's like familiar to the way people were talking, but I don't think a lot of people besides us were really talking about race treason like that. So
no, it's very accurate, right? Yeah. Like that dialogue there is actually very accurate in the way that people were talking. Like it's these kind of, you know, young people who are kind of like idiots, just initially getting a grasp on politics, and they're reading this stuff where you could tell, yeah, it's like some sort of Ignatieff thing turned into a pamphlet that's being shared, you know, on CrimeThink or mm-hmm. something, and then that's what they're reading. So yeah, it's very accurately, I think, grasps kind of the discourse and the feeling of paranoia and whatnot. I also have a soft spot because part of my family is from New Mexico. The one critique I have of it is it's shot in this town called Truth or Consequences. And the town, you know, in the movie is called Eddington. Eddington, A, does not sound like a town in New Mexico. They all have kind of weirder names. And then B, Truth or Consequences would have been a way better title. Yeah.
I would also recommend seeing Begonia. I think it's doing something pretty similar to Eddington, just in terms of the point.
Oh, interesting.
Of it,
yeah. Oh, yeah. I got to see. I haven't seen it yet. I'm a big Clemens head.
This is Plemons in full effect. Do you have any other questions, Sean? I mean, I got like a few other things. We can move towards wrapping up with a... talk about pigs, like feral hogs. But
yeah, let's talk feral hogs. Go ahead and shoot him some feral hog questions.
All right. So yeah, you talk about, you bring up Bordiga a lot, and you seem to be reading Bordiga through Kamat, although you're not like a full Kamatist. You like some of his work, and you're sort of critical of the kind of anti-civ, or, you know, in general, you're critical of whenever revolutionaries are like, all right, it's time to leave. It's time to go to the countryside. It's time to build farm now. And so I think that's sort of your critique of Kamat. But you make a really interesting point in the first chapter, I believe, about the way people change through changing situations, through the changing their environment of the political economy. And the example that you use is that when pigs run away from farms or from slaughterhouses or something, they turn feral almost immediately. And they actually sort of become like a different species that we now call feral hogs that are like overrunning society, because just leaving domestication sort of almost immediately changes your genetics somehow, or like the way your genetics express themselves. So yeah, what are you getting at with that metaphor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the things about these feral hogs, razorbacks, right, is that they get really fucking big. And the reason they get really big is because they have interbred with all of these domesticated pigs that are bred for weight, right? Are bred for mass, to produce more mass. So you have these insane, muscular, gigantic feral, you know, hogs. So the Kamat stuff, I would say a lot of the time what I'm really doing, I open with kind of Kamat in order to kind of deconstruct and look very critically at his idea of domestication. I draw some stuff from him, but I also mobilize a lot of more classical kind of Bordiga and Leninist points against Kamat. But one of the reasons that Kamat is so kind of useful, I think, is because he does express in these things that he's wrong about, he actually expresses, I think, a very intuitive kind of folk political thing that a lot of people sort of realize and becomes sort of this mystical image of capital, and which is sort of the image of capital that I'm trying to, that I myself am trying to kind of dismantle in the book by first engaging with it. And so that's this image of capital as like fully totalizing, as completely conquering everything all the way down to the bottom, such that no revolt is possible. That humanity has become domesticated and is now nothing but a ritual of capital, right? This is the traditional formulation from Kamat. And I argue right in the book that like, there's a reason that capital starts to appear this way to many people, not just Kamat, but also in the public consciousness, through its various kind of faces of, as like a, you know, just a complex technological system or the global economy. It starts to appear in this very similar guise as this totalizing force, as a force of total subsumption, around the time that it becomes genuinely a geospheric system, planetary in scope, where now humans move like anthropic mass sometime between 2016 and 2025 or so, so probably around 2020, now outweighs all the biomass of the entire biosphere, right? So something is actually happening that's giving it kind of this image. But then through all of these things that we were just talking about, these kind of subjectivity factors, right? There's also this idea that in so doing, in creating this vast technical infrastructure that's putting all these people into connection with one another through these intricate divisions of labor, but is de-skilling people, but he's also reskilling people in these more weirder, degraded, partial fashions, right? It is also creating these kind of, as it kind of falls into these momentary kind of crises and these short circuits and these rebellions that it's constantly creating through these kind of things that allow for partisan subjectivity of the type that we were just talking about, right? It enables people to sort of break free, not really escape it, right? But break free from that totalizing kind of logic in such a way that they can then build in the classic formulation, like within and against it, right? They're still immanent to it. They're still organizing within it. They have to address these issues of subsistence. They have to address these. They can't escape to the countryside. They can't go somewhere else outside of capital. Everything is geographically going to be kind of within it. Even if you get to the outside, it's so difficult and you're very, like I said, the very air you breathe is still being affected by it. You go to an island and then suddenly the sea level is rising, right? You're still being impacted by it. So without being able to escape, right, the only thing that you can do is try to stoke these sort of feral subjectivities within the space of domestication such that you can then destroy the foundations of Hellworld. Because the key thing that I sort of stress again and again later on in the book is that when you actually dig into it, right, it's this emergent force, this seemingly kind of totalizing thing, this seemingly like eldritch god sitting above and beyond humanity, right? But it's also something that is produced through human activity, and it's constantly reproduced through human activity. And therefore, when that domesticating environment starts to break down, which it always does because it's internally contradictory, it then creates this opening for this, what Tronti called this kind of refusal, to this spirit of kind of refusal to spread, for people to then reject and break down that system and add in, mobilize it in these partisan forces, mobilize against it and start to invent through that revolutionary process, start to invent, these rational communist kind of methods of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting that the title of the book Hellworld, I don't know if I call it a meme, but it's something that people were saying a lot, mm-hmm. like 15 years ago, maybe. I thought that it came out of sort of this anarchist queer world, because that's the people I knew who was saying it. And you do trace it to that world. And I think that's an example of this kind of cast out subjectivity that's, simultaneously recognizing how grim reality is, like this feeling of no future, of like, because of how I'm treated and how I feel, my life is fucked. But then there's also this sort of political drive to it. And I thought that was a really interesting, I was glad they attributed the title to that moment. Oh, another thing I want to mention is the use of music throughout the book. You talk a lot about these different like hip hop trends in China, different music trends around the world. And then the last chapter has this kind of Merle Haggard soundtrack where you're talking mm-hmm. about Sudan, but it's bringing you back to California, to Bakersfield, listening to country music. And they're listening to country music there too, at the gold mines. At least that's how you make it seem. So one thing is it reminds me a bit of Malcolm Harris's Palo Alto, where, California becomes this model of global development in this broader way. But then also it made me, you constantly remind people that this is a very personal thing for you too, because you're seeing these things, you're feeling it, you're relating it to your experiences. So I guess I just asked, like, what was the function of, like, why do you focus so much on music and culture and subculture throughout the book? Like, what were you trying to do with that?
Well, on the one hand, I think these things are just kind of these immediate expressions of the class experience for people who don't have the political language right to articulate it in other ways, and or where there isn't like the context of a revolt or anything, it's just like the immediate kind of poetry right of proletarian existence. So you always are going to get in touch with the trends, like these kind of political, subjective, political, economic trends in an area also by kind of engaging with these little kind of cultural kind of facets. You also see this kind of lineage of similarity. And so the country music thing in the last chapter is very much about that because, you know, I'm talking simultaneously about these events in Sudan. I have this scene where I'm wandering through northern Tanzania, and in that part of East Africa, Tanzania, Kenya, Zimbabwe, some other kind of areas in that region. Yeah, American country music is huge. Kenya probably more than anywhere else. But
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. You can find in every rural city, like rural town in Kenya, probably like a third of the people will know the lyrics of The Gambler by heart, you know, and everyone knows Dolly Parton. And like, it's just this very, very, salient kind of thing. There's a lot of reasons for it. I talk about it in the book, but the other thing, one of the other reasons for it is that there is a universality, right, to the proletarian experience. Even if the universality is expressed in all these divisions, there is nonetheless a real universality to it. That it, the project of like the partisan project as a whole is basically the project of actually constructing that potential universality that we already see within, like in this broken form within, you know, capitalist life. It's not ready made for us, right? It's not this weird, like post-autonomous kind of view of the collective worker, quoting the Grundrisse, that, you know, thing that, Marx actually changes that paragraph. I talk about that in one of the chapters, but the idea is that there is this kind of thing where you're just like, oh yeah, it is like all this stuff that Merle Haggard is talking about is just like the literal same shit that like that any of these guys would be dealing with, right? Like it's the same stuff over and over and over again. And then I also talk about in the Sudan comparison there, I sort of talk about, let's look at the history of California. Let's look at the history of like militias in California and the California genocide and kind of compare that somewhat loosely, right, to the same sort of thing happening in Sudan, the rise of the rapid support forces, their role as this kind of rural militia. And specifically, there's some of the same, like, there's some similar politics around cattle, right, and pastoralism. And so I'm using those as kind of these kind of loose examples. Oh, one thing I do want to mention, because I think that your listeners will find it useful, is I also have, because I've talked about music so much, I started making all these playlists that I post on my Substack. So I actually have playlists of when I talk about like these weird music genres in northeastern China or Singeli in Tanzania, I actually put together playlists of those things that I release on my Substack alongside just these kind of general playlists for each chapter where I have these posts on them that go into some of like the musical history of certain areas. Like I've got one on a lot of like Chinese rock and some stuff like that. And then the Substack also actually has a bunch of, I have this whole series on it. Just it's called Reading Hell World. And it's where I elaborate on different kind of concepts or themes from the book, kind of in this kind of running thing. And almost all of that stuff is all the free stuff I put up on there. I also have, I have advanced drafts of articles that I do for like people who are paid subscribers, but most of the stuff I post is free up there. And the Substack is called The Planetary Factory. The URL is just philneal.substack.com. And you can find all those playlists on there. So if you're reading about, you know, what is this thing called Hanmai? Like, what is that? And you want to hear it, well, there's a playlist, right?
I'm kind of afraid to listen to Hanmai. I was... There is a, yeah, there were, you just posted a, I mean, in the book, there was an image from one of the videos and it just says like fuck mm-hmm. music or something with this like sort of degraded analog looking. And then, yeah. And oh, I was also very interested in that Hanmai stuff too, because you're sort of talking about the political economy of digital media creation. And so, and that, yeah. You know, that struck home to me as a podcaster. It's like, why did these rural people turn to making weird music and videos and stuff, and then watching their trajectory become sort of trad wives and like trad influencers and stuff. It's incredible to see that happening in China as well. And yeah, I'm right, in the Rust Belt, because there's not a lot of other jobs, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it becomes very much this kind of Rust Belt industry in the Northeast. I mean, it's just national thing. It's huge. I mean, it's very like industrialized now, where there would be like essentially the equivalent of factories or these large warehouse spaces that you rent out, and everyone is streaming like in their own little cubicle. Mm-hmm. And they have, they, you know, you're like renting access to equipment and certain like, broadband amount or something like that. And then you get, I don't know, like helpers, behind the scenes editors, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very industrialized kind of model of service work, which touches on some of the other arguments in the book about like how, you know, mechanization automation, it's kind of like ongoing. I have a future article that's coming out about AI and working in the AI industry, doing all this weird AI training stuff that they do. I'm talking about how that kind of plugs into some of these larger kind of ideas, but it's the same basic theme of like, you are able to mechanize and automate a lot of like services. And it looks really weird, right? But it's going to continue to happen. And it'll have, you know, all of these kind of aspects to it. But yeah, the streaming economy is a very kind of important example of some of those trends that I talk about. And Hanmai is like one of the cultural expressions. If you go to the blog post about that, you can watch that video too. I put the original video up.
It is a Halloween week. I can maybe psych myself up to see that. Although you do make it sound kind of scary. It's probably, you know, I've seen Gigi Allen concerts. It can't be that bad. You know.
Absolutely.
Any other questions before we wrap it up, Sean?
No, I'm good. I got to work the tides tomorrow. So I was just going to say, hell world, baby, fucking, you're really doing it, Phil. Thanks for coming back for a third time. It's always such a pleasure to have you. I think it's three times, right? It's not more.
Might be four. I don't know. But yeah, so obviously this is a very big book. It's very expensive if you were to buy it. How would you recommend people picking it up? And then also maybe some words of encouragement for those who would think like, well, this is too long. I'm never going to read it.
Yeah, so it's kind of this weird thing where because it's one of these historical materialism series books, it's going to be the retail version is like not really even out yet. Right. So it's just sort of circulating through these back channels. It's the only way to really get it, unless you have library access, then you can, you know, have your library get it for you. But it's just like the library edition that's out through Brill right now. The reason for this is because they're the only, like the historical materialism series, I really appreciate that they exist because they're like one of the only publishers that wants to publish, you know, books that are kind of difficult in this sense. So this book is otherwise essentially unpublishable. So the only way to like properly buy it, unless you have, it retails for something crazy. It's the library cost. So it's like $250 or something, mm-hmm. But the $20-$30 version will be out in probably 8 months through Haymarket. Oh, so that's the only way to properly buy it. You know, if you want to like show support, that's one of the reasons I launched the Substack.
Okay.
Is people can like support me there if they want, or if you just want to, you know, most of the stuff, like I said, is free. Just feel free to follow. But yeah, and then there will be a series of kind of, I'm not doing a whole lot of events partially because of that. Like I can't sell the book at anything because I have like one copy left because they sent me six and I gave five to people who had been like readers and stuff. And so I have like one physical copy left at this point. So I can't, I'm not doing like big book tour things. I'll be doing a little panel at the Historical Materialism in London in a couple weeks. a couple weeks from we're recording it, maybe around the same time you guys release, but
I'll put this out on Wednesday.
Oh, okay. So yeah, the a week after it comes out, probably I'll be giving a talk about it in London, but I'll start to do more events too. And especially once the retail version comes out, I'll do more in-person events and try to, you know, make sure copies are accessible.
All right.
If you're looking to do something in New York, hit us up because we'd love to be involved in any sort of release you have when it comes.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So to summarize that, steal this book, but subscribe to that Substack. And I'll just say we might be behind the paywall at this point, but Anna's Archive is a great place to find pretty much any book you want. It's incredible. So you might find Hell World there. Oh, and one more thing before you guys go. I just want to show you, because you just showed your book. I want to show you something too.
What do you got, Andy? Is it something? It's going to be spooky, isn't it? I don't know if I'm prepared to get too scared right now. Oh, God, what is it? Oh, there it is. It exists.
Not as thick as Hellworld, but not
bad. 350, 400 pages?
That's about 400 pages.
Yep. 400
pages. Yeah, that's good.
One of the longest books about baseball ever written.
Nice. I love longer books because you get more book for your buck. That's what I say.
Mm-hmm. That's how I feel. And longer movies too. Yeah.
You were just doing book consumers a huge favor by writing 800 something pages. So we could all thank you for that. Bang for the buck.
All right. Great talking to you, Phil. Have a good night. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, and happy Halloween to everybody.
Happy Halloween to you.
Behind us now. The good time's really over for good. I'll be rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell. With no kind of chance for the flag or the Liberty Bell. I wish a Ford and a Chevy would still last 10 years like they should. The best of the free life behind us now. The good time's really over for good. Stop rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell.
Sing it with me.
Stand up for the flag and let's all ring the Liberty Bell. Let's make a Ford and a Chevy that would still last 10 years like they should. Cause the best of the free life is still yet to come. The good times ain't over for good.